Marx's system of thought was a total system. What consequences, if any, does your theory have for other important Marxian concepts such as alienation?
I think that many Marxists are deterred, and many are hostile to our approach of capital as power. But this hostility, to some extent, I think, is misguided. And it is misguided insofar as we have, in fact, quite a lot in common with Marx's purpose and Marx's method. The difference comes, I think, in that we believe that capitalism has changed fundamentally from the time that Marx was writing, and that change requires that we revisit and that we renew many of Marx's ingenious insights. So there is a room, in our opinion, for major revision in Marxism. But before we go into that question, let me enumerate some of what we feel are important contributions that Marx made, most of which are actually worth keeping. The first one is that Marx did emphasize power. He focused on the material aspect of production as the central of this power structure. So for that reason, his power analysis was concentrated on and to some extent limited to the institution of the surplus. So that is a limitation of his analysis, but his emphasis on power, his preoccupation with power, was certainly novel, and it remains crucial, and it is certainly something that we have taken from him and thoroughly accept. Marx was the first one to make the science of society historical, rather than to treat it as something natural. This is what the classical predecessors of Marx prefer, to think of capitalism and the study of capitalism as the study of a natural phenomenon. And this emphasis of historical science made his analysis empirical rather than merely discursive. So it's very important to see this lineage in our work. I think that we agree with Marx that empirical work is absolutely essential for understanding the historical nature of that order. Marx emphasized in that connection the dialectical tension between history and theory. And that dialectical tension accentuated in Marx the imperative of change, and also, and equally, if not more important, the imperative of the struggle for freedom. And I think, or at least want to think, that we share it very much with him. Marx was the first to make ideology, and by extension theory, part of the very power structure of society. And since every society in Marx is historical, that means that every theory is transitory. Because as societies change, so do their ideologies and theories. And I do not suppose or try to imply that our theory is anything different. Our theory is also transitory, and I don't know, 100 or 200 or 50 years from now, it might become irrelevant. Now, finally, Marx emphasized the totalizing nature of a mode of production, which comes back to your question, and argued that a mode of production determines and encompasses everything. And at the heart of this determination, for Marx, is the process of valuation and the accumulation of surplus value. Now, this is something that we partly share. We also argue that, from our perspective, a mode of power is totalizing, and valuation stands at the heart of it. But what we do not share with Marx is the nature of this totalization and what theory can do about it. But I think that this sort of listing of Marx's kind of underlying contributions should suggest that in many respects we are not very far from him. Where we differ fundamentally is on some of the specifics that can become very important, but nonetheless we also share quite a bit with his purpose and method. Now the problem, again, is with the last point that I made. The problem is with the totalizing nature of a mode of production. And I think that if you think about capitalism as a mode of production and you insist that it's totalizing, you run into a problem. And the problem has two parts. First, I think that capitalism has fundamentally changed. After Marx died, capitalism witnessed multiple developments that made power explicit and pervasive in ways that Marx, in fact, could not even fathom. And to think of capitalism as a mode of production then becomes insufficient. Because if you start with a notion of capital as a material productive economic entity, and then you treat the many facets of power that become so overwhelming, you end up with an irrelevant and, in fact, misleading framework to understand the actual process of accumulation. So that's one problem, and that is that capitalism has fundamentally changed in the sense of the emphasis of power that is not sitting very well with the notion of capitalism as a mode of production. The second point, which is perhaps more fundamental, is the question of whether we can have a totalizing theory of society to begin with and of capitalist society in particular. And many liberals, particularly Karl Popper, criticize this totalizing view. And they argue that such totalizing view is impossible primarily because capitalism is simply too complex for us to be able to internalize this totality and turn it into a reasonably working theory. But I think that there is another aspect that it might actually be deeper than that criticism. Marx believed that value and the accumulation of surplus value as capital can explain both, and the underlying here is on both the capitalist drive, which he symbolically expressed as expanded reproduction, in other words, what Marxists know as MC M prime. So this is the sort of the driving force, the monetary or pecuniary driving force. And it can also explain the resistance of workers to capital, which Marx represented symbolically by the cycle of CMC, that's a reproduction of labor power. Now, this type of dual process, capitalist drive, resistance to capital, one against the other, this type is consistent with the notion of a mode of power. But if capital is not a productive entity, as we claim, but is rather a power institution, then valuation and accumulation can explain only one aspect of society. It can only explain the side of the rulers, and it cannot at all explain the side of those who are ruled. The rule of capital is totally mechanized in the sense that capitalist rulers are conditioned to obey the very logic they impose on society. In order to rule, you have to have a singular vision. You can never actually compromise that vision by seeing the world from the other side. You have to be single-minded. And for that reason, rulers scarcely, if ever, can transcend their class consciousness. Now, this mechanization of the ruling class in capitalism enables us, as researchers, to understand the process of accumulation, and it enables us to maybe roughly delineate the boundaries of accumulation and sometimes even predict the trajectory of accumulation. And I would even add that perhaps this is the only area where the behavioral sciences can tell us something valid about society, because they're dealing with something mechanized. Although it changes slowly, it's still so mechanized that it has some stability to it. But we cannot say the same thing about those who are ruled. Now, most of the time, the underlying population that is ruled indeed obeys the mechanical dictates of capital. And this obedience makes them predictable to the same extent. But that's not always the case. Occasionally, the underlying population protests, and sometimes it revolts. And these acts of resistance and revolt, we argue, are autonomous. I mean, maybe the best example is, say, May of 68, a revolution that nobody predicted. Even the people who actually were at the center of this revolution could not predict it. this was essentially an autonomous act that could not be deduced from the logic of capital. What we are trying to argue is that resistance is not part of the logic of capital, and that despite endless attempts by the social sciences to kind of trap these deviant acts, if you like, and control them and try to characterize them and therefore be able to predict them, these attempts have more or less failed, in our opinion. It's impossible to really understand and predict resistance to capital from understanding the logic of capital itself. It's something else that we are dealing with. And as a result of these two considerations, I think that accumulation has become a mysterious process if it is to be understood from the dual perspective that Marx has taken. Marx's original category of value is a category that is supposed to explain both sides of accumulation, and I think it ends up explaining neither. The neo-Marxists, who have abandoned value, no longer even claim to have a unit with which they can explain both the side of the rulers and the side of the ruled. Now, this is a serious breach. I think it had far-reaching consequences for the development of Marxism, because if you accept that Marx's value theory in its quantitative sense no longer stands, then the totality of the mode of production loses its unifying anchor. Again, valuation is supposed to explain MCM prime and CMC, but valuation doesn't exist, and if it doesn't exist, neither of these processes can be quantitatively articulated. So you lose the anchor. And in the absence of that anchor, Marxism has no choice but to fracture. And that is exactly what happened historically. Marx had in mind and tried to create a singular totality that is anchored in his notion of valuation. But instead of that totality, once this process of valuation started to disintegrate, Marxism has started to fracture, and it now stands on a tripod. There are, in fact, three neo-Marxist approaches that are only loosely related and sometimes in fairly contradictory ways. Now, what are these three different approaches? The first one is neo-Marxian economics. And neo-Marxian economics essentially tries to assess and emphasize the effect of power on economics. So they deal with things such as monopoly capital and government intervention, etc. But at the same time, they retain the presumption that capital itself can still be understood separately from these power effects. So you have a conception of pure capital, and then you have conceptions of power that affect it and distort it from the outside. This is the basis, if you like, of neo-Marxian economics. Then you have another part of the tripod, cultural studies. Cultural studies concentrate on the importance of capitalist ideology, capitalist culture, capitalist gender relation, race, etc. But it has next to nothing to say, certainly not concretely, about the processes of accumulation. And finally, you have the last segment of the tripod is state theory. And state theory tries to dissect the institutions of formal politics at the same time that it takes the economics of accumulation. And remember that the definitions of classical and neo-Marxist economics are something that they do not agree on. So they take the economics of accumulation as if it were given. So the analysis is an analysis of state institutions based on a certain understanding of capitalist economics from a Marxist perspective, but that Marxist perspective is not something that Marxists agree on. So there are deep dividing lines, if you like, between these three elements of the tripod. Now, the consequence of this fractured tripod are really very serious, because neo-Marxism no longer exists as a unified approach, let alone as a totalizing one. And many of the most fundamental concepts of neo-Marxism really, as a consequence, hang out sort of in suspension. Let me give a few illustrations to give these claims some substance. Let's consider, for instance, the distinction between productive and unproductive labor. Classical Marxism thinks of productive labor as something that generates surplus value. And according to this definition, unproductive labor is something that merely uses surplus value. Now, with neo-Marxism, for instance, the neo-Marxism of monopoly capital, there is necessary labor which creates surplus, and there is unnecessary labor that wastes or absorbs the surplus. Now, if you take these definitions and, say, apply them to military expenditures, both classical and neo-Marxists, classical Marxists and neo-Marxists, see military expenditures as unproductive. But they draw completely different conclusions from that assumption. Classical Marxists come from the side of production, and because military spending uses the surplus, it serves to undermine accumulation, because this surplus cannot be plowed back into accumulation. The neo-Marxists come from the consumption side or demand side, and because military spending absorbs the surplus, it actually serves to propel accumulation. So we have very, very different perceptions, and there is really no way to reconcile them, because the basic categories that both sides use, value, surplus, accumulation, all of these entities are economic objective entities on paper, but in practice they're not. And therefore, there is no really a systematic way to settle the dispute, and this is a fundamental dispute. One would argue that military spending sort of boosts accumulation, and the other that it undermines it, and there's no way to reconcile between them, because there's no totality here that we agree on. Or take the concept of intellectual property rights. For some Marxists, intellectual property rights are a form of productive investment. Other Marxists see intellectual property rights as a power-based distortion. But because there is no connect between the state structures that impose the property rights and the economics of production, there is really no objective mechanism to settle this difference. Or think of, say, state theory in connection with the recent invasions of the Middle East, of Afghanistan, of Iraq, etc. There are some theories to think of the state as a relatively autonomous entity, autonomous from the processes of accumulation. And for some of these theories, these wars were an attempt to reassert, say, the deterrence of a declining power. There are other theories who think of the U.S. as a capitalist empire, and for these theories, the invasions aimed at various goals. They had various goals, for instance, taking over the oil resources of the region, or lowering the price of oil, or bolstering the U.S. dollar, etc. Now, interestingly, all of these claims were subsequently invalidated. It's quite obvious that the deterrence of the United States has been quite reduced by these invasions. I think it's quite obvious that the price of oil, instead of falling, soared. It rose, in fact, 7 to 14-fold relative to the time before the invasion. The U.S. administration, which was supposed to invade Iraq in order to bolster the U.S. dollar immediately after the invasion, announced that it wanted the dollar to devalue. U.S. companies that were supposed to take over oil resources revealed no interest whatsoever when Iraqi oil resources were auctioned, etc. Now, because again, there is almost a complete disconnect between the politics of state on the one hand and the economics of accumulation on the other, people who made these predictions do not seem to be very bothered by the fact that those predictions did not materialize. And again, we end up with a very, very fractured type of analysis that lacks a yardstick, that lacks some means of verification and refutation. So I think that the net result of all of that is that Marxism no longer has sort of a viable historical role. It in fact lost its force as a historical agent. Now, part of the reason of that disintegration of Marxism as a historical force is undoubtedly rooted in the communist regimes of the 20th century, many of which did everything they could to turn Marxism from a vibrant science, which it was during the 19th and early 20th century, into religion and often into a state religion. So that's one reason for the diminishing role of Marxism. But I think that there is another reason that is also very important. And that is that Western Marxists have gradually given up on trying to revise and change their basic approach. And because they have given up this attempt to revise and change their approach, they ended up caving in almost completely to liberal economics. And liberal economics ended up taking over, surprisingly as it may seem, taking over many aspects of Marxism. Let me give you a few illustrations. Marxists have never developed a unique accounting method that is different from liberalism, and therefore they are practically forced to adopt the method of accounting that the capitalists use. Similarly, Marxists have never developed their own databases, and therefore they end up using the databases that the capitalists give them. Marxists have not devised new tools of empirical research, and therefore they have gravitated almost completely toward liberal tools. They use the same statistics, they use the same econometrics, and they use the same concept of equilibrium and disequilibrium that the liberals use. Now, when you come to investigate the actual political economy of our time, Marxists, as a consequence, do not have the concept, they do not have the data, they do not have the tools with which they can articulate a unique Marxist cosmology of the capitalist society. Essentially, they have lost the initiative, I think, and I'm saying it very sadly, and they slowly retreated as a consequence to a role of commentators and interpreters of the capitalist media, because they do not control that media anymore, in other words, the numbers and the methods. The bottom line, in my opinion, is that we need another anchor. If Marxism indeed disintegrated, as we are claiming, into a fracture of subdisciplines because of the disintegration of its main anchor, in other words, the labor theory of value, because Marxists have given up the labor theory of value and haven't developed an alternative theory of value instead, that means that we need a new theory of value to create an anchor on the basis of which we can develop alternative accounting, alternative data, alternative methods, and eventually an alternative that might actually replace the capitalist mode of power.